Hey everyone, how are we all doing? Everyone excited for the party later on today? Cool, so let's get started with some load testing. I'm gonna jump right into it. I didn't expect a response, by the way. So I'll just start with a bit of background about me. So I'm Upinder Singh. I'm a software developer at Intigent in the modern applications team. I come with a mechatronics engineering background, but I have a deep passion for software, and I got to realize that last year with a couple of my friends as we presented for the Imagine Cup World Finals, which was an awesome experience. I'm also a huge Formula One fanboy, so come have a chat to me afterwards or tweet me at DevelopPanda. Cool, so let's get started with some. So one of the projects that I got to work on while at Intigent was a long-running ERP project. So this has a lot of components. So there's an Angular app, there's a Windows Phone app, and they're all both communicating through their own APIs into a central API. And then they're hitting all of these different services. So CRM, AX, SQL, Azure Blob, some third-party scheduling and pricing clients, and also synchronous and asynchronous queues in the background to do all this background processing. So it's a highly customized, highly complex solution. There's 10 developers working on it just in our office. It's a multinational project, so different aspects are being handled by different teams, so there's a lot of stuff going on, and the entire project is on-prem. So all the APIs, everything is private, except obviously the phone API, so you can communicate from outside. And I essentially came onto this project to do some load testing, and this is my first time load testing, so there's a lot of learnings to be had there as well. And the main question that I was being asked the entire time was, how many users can we handle? Now, what does that really mean? There's a lot of variables at play. So there's a lot of variables at play. But you can narrow down the question and ask, how does the system respond at the expected load? This is a bit easier to answer because you can define what that expected load is, and it's not as ambiguous. But that also leads to other questions like how does the system respond at peak load or above peak, or what things fail first and how will my users be impacted by those failures? You can also ask performance questions like what are the current bottlenecks and what do we anticipate to be bottlenecks as the load increases? And if there's currently, in the current setup, if there's any small changes we can make to have a huge impact. So all of these questions can kind of guide you back to answering that first one a bit more objectively, but these are the ones that we were trying to answer with our project. So I'll quickly start with a case study just to bring it to a smaller context. So this is Bestler. They're an electric car vehicle manufacturer, and they're bringing their vehicles to New Zealand soon. They have a web portal, which has an authentication aspect, a central API, hitting some third-party tools, SendGrid and scheduling, and then some background stuff that's also happening. So I'll quickly demo that. So this is their website. The users would come in, and they can either choose to purchase or test drive a vehicle. So they'd go to test drive, sign in with their details, and you can see all the respective HTTP requests happening on the side. Select a country, city and postcode. I'll say I want to test drive the Model B, and this will go out and search for appointment slots closest to me depending on my zip code or my location. So it's found some. I'm going to choose Jefferson Motors, say today at 1 p.m. Actually, that's in the past, tomorrow at 1 p.m. It'll do the booking, and this will now send me an email with a confirmation link, and I, as a user, have to open up my email and click the link before the entire appointment process has finished. So naturally, when they launch this, they want Bestler. They want to ensure that their users don't have a degraded experience. You could have thousands of users from across the country trying to book test drives in different places. So naturally, they would go to load test this. They could just hammer the system, right? They could just fire tons of requests at it and monitor the servers and see when it falls over, but that doesn't necessarily help us answer any of those questions. So having some sort of structured plan in place can really help you justify your results and your findings, and it also helps to keep the tests standard, and you can compare them. It keeps them comparable. So I'm just going to quickly cover some of the background and the theory behind load testing, which is common between the different approaches and the different tools that you use, which I'll dig into a little bit. Cool. So the first thing you do is you'd evaluate the system as a tester or a developer or whoever's running the test. So that's consulting the users and any key stakeholders and basically identifying what is happening in the system. Now, if you've developed the system yourself, if you're the developer, this is a bit easier to do, but that's not an excuse to not document it, because again, it helps you justify your findings at the end. Next, you dig further into your marketing material and any SLAs, and even historical data, and pull out your quantifiable metrics, which become your acceptance criteria. These are things like could be things like page load times or any request throughput, or even business metrics. So in the case of Bessler, it could be how many test drives can it schedule within an hour, or how many need to be handled within an hour. After that, at this point, you have enough insight to identify the most critical and performance intensive user activities, and they turn into your scenarios, your load test scenarios, and then you go and implement these into your tool or whichever harness you're using. So something that's common between all of these is you need to make sure that your scenarios, the way you implement them or the way you design them, that they're only affected by user load. So the most, a common example could be stock levels. So if you have stock levels that are running out between your two different runs and they're causing failures, well, then you're testing how your system is handling with low stock, not with a varying user load. So you need to eliminate all of these bottlenecks that aren't really affected by you changing load. It's safe to assume that your users aren't superhuman, so they're not clicking and stepping through and reading data within milliseconds of each other. So you put in think time so that your overall scenario runtime is a reasonable estimation. It should be parameterized. So in the case of the Bessler example, I would parameterize the zip code. So each scenario run, it's choosing a different zip code. It's testing and it's trying to book an appointment at a different location. So it's not overloading just that one area. Pay attention to your fail conditions. These aren't only exceptions. They're not just response code, so 500's coming back from your servers. This can also be proactive checks against your acceptance criteria. So if a particular SLA hasn't been met, then you can kind of fail the scenario there. Or even data checks, so data coming back, you validate that. And lastly, they need to be realistic, but don't get trapped in that, because you can, and it can be a real pain, and the scenario can just get really complex without having a big impact. So don't get trapped in that, strive for perfection. After this, you design your load profile. This is the control system around adding and removing users or adding and removing load. The profiles vary depending on the questions you're trying to answer, which I'll explain in a little bit. But what's common between all of them is you ramp and hold that sort of design. So say if I want to go to 200 users, I would add them in 50 increments. And if I'm adding 50, I wouldn't add them in 1 minute. You'd add them over, say, maybe 5 minutes. So you're not surprising the system. You're not causing it to fail. You're just slowly adding your load on. And this is quite an important fact. Then you take all the config and you test and monitor the solution in a controlled environment. This should be a given. So you run it after hours, make sure there's no one in the system. Turn off any applications or clients that are open on your servers if it's on-prem. And that's, again, to take away as many variables as you can so that your tests are comparable. An important one is, and I found this during testing, is to switch your logging down to production levels. So you might have really verbose logging as you're developing, which could be serializing and deserializing a lot of stuff. And that step, when it's scaled out and you have a lot of them, does add a significant load onto the servers as well, which can use up a lot of resources. So turn them down to your production levels, whatever you estimate them to be. You monitor your servers, so it could be New Relic, Application Insights, whatever, and monitoring metrics that are specific to helping you answer your acceptance criteria. And also monitor the computer that's actually generating the load if you're running an on-prem test, because you don't want that to become the bottleneck itself. Then you analyze the results, correlate the observations between your tests, and identify any changes that need to be made. And then you make those changes, and while you're unsatisfied or while the acceptance criteria hasn't been met, you just loop through those last three steps until they are met. So So I'll jump into some of the test profiles. So there's kind of three main tests. And so a load test, I guess, is just it's you're ramping your load up just to expected. You're not going in above. You're just going up to expected. And it's just to generate your baseline and see how your system responds within the bounds that you're expecting to see. And I mean, it's a given, but you should have a high success rate here, so not a lot of failures. Because if you have failures, that means your users can also expect to have failures in that sort of range, which isn't really good. Then you'd run a stress test, which is quite similar, except you're overloading the system and you're just ramping way beyond the expected load. And this is kind of more exploratory testing, and you're trying to see what things fail and the impact that that failure might have and how gracefully it's handled, those sort of things. Then you run an endurance test. You ramp up to or just below the expected load, and then you just hold it for 4 hours or even more, depending on the context of your solution. And it's, I guess, to identify memory issues or any problems with any long-running processes. These are kind of the main three that there are. So I just want to give one word. So I mentioned load here instead of users. I want to give a word about why the term concurrent users is ambiguous, or it can be ambiguous in certain contexts. So if you have, for example, 50 users, they can run 100 scenarios in 1 hour. But 25 users can do 100 scenarios in an hour working at twice the speed. So which one's better? Because the server is still seeing 100 scenarios being run in an hour. It's still seeing the same traffic. So I guess a metric that's easier to justify and understand could be scenario throughput. And if you know your scenario throughput and you know how efficiently your users are working that you're simulating, then you can calculate back and estimate the user count. But the user count itself can be ambiguous in some terms. Cool, so let's get practical. So the theory is there for understanding, but what are the tools that you can use when you actually want to go and implement this? So the first question that comes to mind is if your application is public or it's private, or your APIs are public or if they're private. So if you're public, there's loader.io, Visual Studio Online. There's a lot of online cloud services that can generate load to your server, to your application from a remote location. But if you go back to my example, our project was entirely on-prem, so that rules out pretty much all of those cloud tools. And you're kind of restricted to Visual Studio Enterprise, which has a load test tool within, Neoload, which is another one, and JMeter, which is an open source Java application. And these are the kind of the main three that you can use. There are others that you can use to generate load on-prem. So all of these are quite mature, and they're relatively quick to configure, so you can pretty much run an entire test without having to write a line of code. Because, for example, Visual Studio can intercept everything you're doing in Internet Explorer and record those requests to replay them, which is pretty nice. So that essentially gets translated to a web test within Visual Studio Code. You can convert that to a coded web test, or you can write a unit test. And the more you go towards code, the more you lose the logging aspects and the timing aspects that it has, because if you're just writing a unit test and running that as a scenario within Visual Studio, it's not intercepting the request that you're making. It's just timing the entire test duration. So there's kind of a balance between what you can and can't do there. They all have integrated reporting, a tool within Visual Studio will hook into Application Insights if your application is instrumented with that, and pull those logs into the report, which is pretty nice. They're all customizable with plugins. So for example, with JMeter, you can run a small Java executable within as one step of the scenario. They all have, apart from JMeter, which is open source, they all have a licensing cost that isn't insignificant, so that can be a blocker for some teams, or for some smaller teams. As I said, Visual Studio's tool is only available in the Visual Studio Enterprise Edition. So a lot of these tools, and there's some, I guess, more pros and cons, but a lot of these tools are sufficient for, like, even relatively complex applications, and you can do a lot of work with them. But if we go back to my original project, which has all of these different aspects and different ways that users can communicate and different clients that you're calling out to and all these background things happening, trying to implement an end-to-end scenario for that application into one of these tools was getting quite complex. And because they're customizable, trying to customize them to suit the scenario and pull out the logs that I needed was also getting really complex and really involved. And obviously we're developers, so there should be a better way. And so we decided to use a code-based approach. And I'm kind of going to explain why. So I'm not going to go through these tools and how to use them. I'm just going to talk about what we did. So with our scenarios, because CRM was an aspect, a lot of the scenarios required an entity or a job to be created within CRM to be used in the rest of the scenario. And this was kind of the first step. Now, if you use those traditional methods and you try and intercept everything that CRM is doing when it's trying to make those calls, it's generating hundreds of SOAP requests, which one, you don't want to set up manually, and two, you can't replay them. So trying to replay any of these, they either throw errors or nothing really happens because of just how the CRM application works. But with a code-based approach, we in our existing project, we already had the clients to communicate with CRM. So all I had to do was CRM Gateway, create me a job. And that creates me a job, and I can use that over the rest of the scenario. So there's some things here of not load testing CRM end-to-end, but I'm not going to dig into that here because that's a separate sort of topic. The next one is data extraction and data flow. So if you want to use the response data from one request, do some processing on it, and then pass it into the request of another, or of a subsequent request, which is common in some of the complex web applications that we start to get, with the standard tools, the top one is JMeter, you're stuck to using regex or writing a plugin to use code to extract stuff out. And if you're writing regex, you're doing it on every single request, and then you're injecting it into the JSON body of every single other request. And that JSON body could be 200 lines long, however long. You don't really want to be doing that. Visual Studio is a bit nicer. It has extraction rules that you can add to the requests to search for a specific field, or even write a custom one like this, which is it'll intercept and do some work. But again, you're doing this for every single request. But with a code approach, we've already got all the C# models. They're all already existing in the project. So all I have to do is deserialize my response into that model, and I can just use the fields as you would with any sort of code or unit test, which leads me to my next point. So as I said, there's 10 developers working on this. I'm not monitoring what everyone is doing at every single check-in. What if a design change results in one of the models like having a property removed or a field removed? So a vehicle DTO is one of them. And say someone at some point removes a stock level. With the standard approaches, if I'm trying to do some regex to pull out the stock level in my scenario, I'm then a week later finding out that, oh, it's not there anymore, and I'm trying to debug through regex, and everyone knows that's not fun. But with a code approach, your build immediately breaks because it's in the code, and if it can't compile, then it can't compile. And so it surfaces that problem up straight away, and you're first forced to address it. And maintaining these scenarios can become a real pain. And if you can't track everything that's changing, then you're kind of recording the scenario again and again every single time a change happens, because if the models are really complex, then it's easier just to do it from scratch. But with this way, you're seeing it straight away. Some other things. So again, going back to the original project, some aspects that aren't visible at the user interface. So you may want to fail or succeed a scenario if a background process didn't run. With the standard tools, you're either standing up another web service to check that happened, but with this, you can kind of just query through code through your clients that you've already got written and validate that background process has run in the specified time. And leading on from that, you can tie into the existing clients that you've already got written up for all of these different tools, and you're not kind of writing different types of requests for them. You can have multi-client scenarios. So if you have a user scenario, again, going back to our original project, if you have a user scenario that's going from a web interface to a third-party scheduling client to mobile and then back to web, you can simulate all of these requests that these scenarios are doing. You can simulate all the web requests because you're just writing it. You're not having to record. So you can have a truly end-to-end scenario written in your code. You can add it to your CI pipeline. So you can run each scenario as a unit test and validate that it's working every single time someone checks in. And I mean, yeah, we're developers. We love control, flexibility, and freedom, right? So you can modify it to exactly what you want for your particular use case. Just to summarize, why code? So it allows developers to run the load test by implementing completely end-to-end scenarios that through the reuse of code that they've already written. You're not rewriting anything. And code also simplifies the data flow and validations and allows for complex workflows while being understandable, maintainable, and always up to date. So, what does it take to build a code-based harness from the ground up? What are the different components of this? So the first one is you need some sort of input config. You need to be able to input your load profile, your scenarios, all of that stuff, and you need some sort of interface for that. So this can be any sort of application. It could be console, could be WPF, could be UWP, any sort of app to interact. That takes all the config and puts it into the test runner, which is controlling how the users are added and removed. So it's kind of that control system, and it's controlling how your entire test is running. Then you need something to actually be the user and simulate the user and execute the steps that the user would be doing. So that's your scenario runner, which is preparing data and hitting the servers, running through the scenario. You need something to time all of these things that the users are doing. And then you need something to log all of that timing data. So it could be writing to SQL or log4net into CSV files or just console, anything you want. Then you need something to monitor the servers, so application insights or server monitoring. So it could be New Relic, which is what we chose to use. But there's all of these different ones. And then you need something to collate all of those logs, all of that data into your reporting, because what's a test if you can't report on it? So I chose to use Power BI for this. So this is the exact structure of a harness that I've already put together in C# and already used on an extensive project, hoping to make it open source soon. But I want to kind of speak through and describe some of the design decisions that I made and how I implemented some things, because when you're building it from scratch and when you're designing it, you can, when you're not sort of building on top of existing ones, you can put in things and put in design features that you can't do otherwise. So let's jump into a demo, into code now. Wake up. Cool, so I've, as I said, so it's basically a set of libraries that I've already written up. So they're just libraries. You need to implement them in some sort of application. So I'm going to demo with a console app. But regardless of what you use, and regardless if you use this library or you decide to build your own or any hand roll some other sort of way to fire these requests, one of the key things is there's a setting within system.net that's set by default, which describes what's the maximum number of connections that an application can make to a particular host. And that, by default, is set to 2. And I found this out with a lot of pain and sweat to figure out why my harness was slowing down when I'm not even doing anything. So something that should be taking half a second was taking 20 seconds to run. And that's because my computer was throttling that and it was slowing it down. So override that and set it to some sort of reasonable value that will ensure that your harness itself and your application isn't the bottleneck. This is kind of just a big disclaimer that I wanted to put out there. Cool, so if we run through the main method, essentially I'm setting up three different things. So I'm setting up my loggers. As I said, it's implemented as a logging interface. So can everyone see? Yep, it's implemented as a logging interface. So I've chosen to implement two different types of loggers. One of them is a file logger, which will dump out all of my data into a CSV file so I can just snapshot it. And the other one is just a dot dash logger, and it's writing to the console so I can kind of see what's going on. Then I'm setting up my test configuration. So this is my scenario config. My scenario config. And then my test period config, so that it's loading those both from just config files. So this one here, the test period config, there's two periods in here, and it's saying that in the first period, ramp up and add 8 users over 30 seconds. So it'll add 8 users every X number of seconds. And then the next one is saying, hold it constant for 5 minutes. So I'm ramping up to 8 and then just holding it constant. So it loads that, loads that from my config file. And then I've got also a custom configuration. So this is basically implemented on top of a dictionary, just restricted. And I can load things from like a test environment. So I can just quickly switch the environment just by flipping a switch on app.config and some other things, but also parameterizing data. So I can dump in all of my zip codes that I want to use for this particular test into here. And I can limit this. So I could say my testers, my real life testers, that they use this group of zip codes, so they're booking against these branches, and then my load test can use this one, so you can restrict that. So that's all my config set up. And then a scenario resolver, which is essentially a one-to-one mapping. So if I get a scenario that's titled schedule test drive, if I get that in, what do I need to run? So that's essentially, it's just returning an instance of this the scenario itself. I'll dig into this in a little bit. Cool, so we've got our three main things that we need to set up, and all of that just gets passed into a load test runner, which is the second aspect that I showed in that graph before. Yep, add it into the load test runner, and then it basically goes to execute the method. Now this execution, so this test runner is, you implement it once, it's part of the library, and you're not, I'm not gonna talk through this too much because it's kind of just the plumbing behind it, but essentially it's using timers and event handles and just triggers to generate the profile using that config that you pass in. And it'll basically control the adding and removing of users. But there's one thing I want to point out. So say you're randomly adding 100 users in your scenario over X number of minutes. You don't want to introduce any patterns of you adding them, because different scenarios can have different load profiles. And if you just loop through your three scenarios and add them one by one, that can introduce patterns within your test results, which can kind of throw them off. So when I define my scenario config, I'm saying there's these two scenarios, and they have a weighting of 75% and 25%, and then some extra information saying if they should loop and if it should wait X number of minutes before looping. But that's essentially a weighting, so it's like a 3-to-1 weighting. Within the test load test runner, I have implemented an algorithm, a weighted random selection. So it'll use that weighting. It'll use that weighting on my config, and say if I wanted to add 100 users, at the end it'll ensure that I have 75 and 25 off the two, but they'll be added in a random fashion using that weighting. So once we've identified what's the scenario that we need to run when we're adding one user, we then go and add in our users. So this is a scenario runner, which is the third step in that diagram. The scenario runner is the thing that's controlling the actual running of the scenario. It's controlling the user. We launch that into a thread saying, oh, I have a thread that basically runs the run method off the runner. That's funny. Saves the runners and the threads so that I can stop them later when I want to halt the test, and then basically kicks it off, and it just says, go, do what you need to do, use that config, and it just does, it just keeps working in its own thread. Cool. So now that we've identified, we've given a thread a particular scenario to run with that name, we need to jump into the actual scenario. So now it'll go into my scenario resolver, and it'll say, okay, I need to run this test. Give me an instance of that, the implementation of that scenario. So I'll jump into that scenario. Now, I've chosen to implement every scenario as an implementation of the iScenario interface, which basically has one run method, and it returns a result saying if it was successfully run or not. It takes in a parameter, which is some user ID, session ID, some config information, and then a time tracker. So now's a good time to explain how I've implemented the timing aspect. So I will jump back into my slides for that. Cool. So I've decided to implement the timing as a bottom-up approach, because every request, so say if you have a scenario which has four steps or four requests, the overall runtime of the scenario should just be the runtime of those four requests, and it should ignore anything else that's happening. So any data processing steps, any serialization, it shouldn't really pay include that in the overall runtime. So I've implemented like a bottom-up approach. On the left-hand side, there's a diagram of what the timer is actually doing, and then the implementation on the right. So essentially, I'll kick off, create a new timer, and then I'll execute some setup steps, which take half a second to run. And then I'll execute the actual request, which takes a second to run. But if I put some logging in to say show what the time tracker has at that point in time, we can see that at A and B, the time is still recorded at 0 seconds. But at C, after it's recorded the step, it's at 1 second. So this is showing the selective nature of the timing. Now if we go into the different layers, so again, I'll start with a parent tracker. And I'll generate a child off that. So the child has a reference to the parent. It knows what the parent is. And then inside the child, I will do some requests. So this will record for a second. And then when the child disposes, it adds all of its recordings back onto the parent that it's been linked to. So if we, again, put some more logging into here and see what's happening, at both A and B, everything is at zero. At C, the child has a second on it because it's recorded a second, but the parent doesn't have anything on it. But once the child disposes and it's finished its timing, it'll join that back onto the parent. Now, if we combine this concept and the selective timing concept and pull it out into the logging, so I wanted to have short-lived timers. You could choose how you want to implement the timer, but you don't want to have a stopwatch open for a long duration. So I decided that the best approach was to have short-lived timers, and the timing entity and the thing that's storing the results of the timing, they're stored on separate things. So the results of the timing is the stuff that can be logged and that can be long-lived, but the timer itself is short-lived. So this is an implementation of how I would do that. So if we generate a parent tracker, and then inside this aggregate method, it's just a wrapper, it'll say aggregate, add up all of my child trackers and see how much my total runtime is. And then once that finishes, save it in the scenario timing object, which I will generate before this starts. So we'll go into this inside that aggregate method. We'll generate a child from that parent. And just like before, execute a request that takes 1 second. But this time, notice how we're saving it into an entity. And then the child gets disposed, and then it gets added back onto the parent. Then we'll think for 5 seconds, because between our two steps, we want to add a think time. So we'll think for 5 seconds, generate a new child tracker for the next request. Now this one has some setup tasks, which might be half a second, could be 10 seconds. And then we'll execute the next request, which is also a second. And then the child disposes and joins back onto the parent. So at this point, at the end of the method, all of our timers have been disposed. They're not long-lived. They'll be living for a number of seconds. But we've got all of our data to be logged, and it's saved. And you can choose how you log this using your logging interface. So we can see here that request A and B both have a second on it. That's what's being logged, as well as some other metadata. And then the scenario timing has 2 seconds on it, and it's excluding all the other stuff that I did. Cool. So this is a two-layer implementation. But if I take all of this concept back onto how I implemented the actual thing, the actual scenario. So I've used a three-layer interface, like a three-layer design. So we have scenarios, we have user actions, and then the requests. And this, each of those things, the logs will answer different questions for you when you go to process them at the end. So basically, each scenario is built up of many user actions. So if we go back to my best list scenario, it could be the clicks and entering data. And then each user action is built up of the constituent REST requests that it's making inside. And then the data processing steps in between. So we'll jump back into code. Yep, so as I said before, the three layers. So we've got our scenario layer, which is basically this entire class. We have our user actions, so a web user simulator and an email user simulator, which is basically every method on that class is a click. So clicking the test drive button, clicking sign in, selecting a country. And then inside here, inside these, inside each of these, we have all of the requests that it's making to its subsequent clients. So if I run through the sign-in process, which has a number of steps, I'll, using my config that I entered right at the start, I'll pick a random user to sign in as. So I'm not always signing in as the same user. And I'll request the authentication from the server, which is basically just a REST request. It's returning me some headers, and in the header, there's a authentication token, which I need to use in every single subsequent request. So I will pass that in, and I have a request builder, which is saying, intercept every subsequent request that I'm making and inject this token into the headers. So I'm just doing this once, this setup. Then I select get my account details, again, another REST request, saving that authenticated account as a session. Then I'm starting the test drive booking, and this is returning me a cookie with a booking ID. And then again, I want to use that booking ID. So I guess this is specific to this scenario, but what it's demonstrating is how you can use the data and flow it through and save it just by using like regular objects, not by doing any funky regex. And again, with the timing, all of this data processing is excluded except the REST requests. Only that stuff is included in the timing. So this is kind of where it starts to get nice. So you noticed on one of the last steps, when I select the vehicle and I click confirm, when I select the vehicle, it's searching for some appointment slots and it's returning them to me. So it could be 10, 15 objects that it's being returned. So I just deserialize that straight away into a list. Again, that deserialization is not included in the timing. I include that into the list and I can pick a random element to use, so less chance of two users picking the same element. And then the next request, I can just use that same object and pass it through saying, I want to book this appointment as the confirm appointment. Now, that confirm appointment is always returning me a 200, so I can't, from the response code, I don't know if it's failed or succeeded, but the data coming back has a flag on it saying if it was successful or not. Now, this is, I guess, just an example of picking out a Boolean. It could be true or false. But say you're picking out a big data object and you want to do some checks on that. You can't do that with regex, or it'll be a real pain to do that with regex. I can just basically check if it was unsuccessful. If it was unsuccessful, I can fail the scenario immediately there. It was successful, but now I have a SLA saying that a user gets an email within 60 seconds of them clicking that confirm button, just so they know that something's happening, right? So I need to validate that email has been sent within the 60 seconds, because if the server's under high load, that SLA might not be met. So the user might still have an okay experience, but my actual sort of acceptance criteria is still not being met. So what can I do? I'm using SendGrid to send the email, so I can just check against SendGrid to see if that email has been sent or has been delivered. Obviously, this isn't the exact syntax, but you can query SendGrid and be like, has this email been sent? So if it has been sent, great. If it hasn't, then you can fail the scenario and say that the background process didn't run in time. Say it did run in time, and the user got an email with a link. You can query SQL because you have the client written up. You can query SQL directly and pull out the link that was sent to the user in the email and then simulate the user clicking that link from the email. And so now you can see how the user will experience, like how long that will take. So if them clicking a confirm button or a confirm link takes a minute to process, then that's not good either, because how do they know that it's actually worked? So you can validate that part of the user experience is also working. So it's kind of implementing an end-to-end scenario. And then again, to reiterate, you querying all of these different clients is excluded from the runtime. So it doesn't matter how long they take. You want to validate that the user's experience is still okay. And you can kind of implement like the end-to-end scenario here. So that's just a really brief summary. I haven't implemented the timing aspects directly, but they're all kind of inside the interfaces and they're being intercepted, and they're just helper methods. So I explained how the timing is working, but you don't necessarily need to implement that. So say say your application is instrumented with Application Insights. So if I quickly kick off a test, not that one. So I don't want to, I guess, take down the network here. So it's a really sort of lightweight test. And it's just adding a couple of users to hit the scenario. So there's a plus, a user's been added, and then it'll be doing its subsequent requests, I hope. Yep. So there's some requests going through. Now, because my application is instrumented with Application Insights, just out of the box, I get some live metrics, and I can monitor my test running and any exceptions that are coming through. So we should see some requests coming through, and any exceptions that happen, we can track them immediately. Now, when Application Insights, when you instrument your JavaScript in just a normal application, every time a user comes in, it generates a new user ID and a new session ID and sends them as cookies into every single request. And that's what Application Insights uses to link all of the logs together to a particular user session. So because in our run parameters for the scenario, we already have that information, and every time a scenario is run or every time a user is added, a new ID is generated for that person. Why not just pass that through into Application Insights and spoof the client? So I'll jump into this. Let me stop that test real quick. I'll jump into the Application Insights portal and say, I'll look at the failed requests for some of the exceptions that have happened. Let's make it interactive. Look at the failed requests and then say, I'll jump into the confirm purchase because that I can see that that's had a number of failures. Design has also had failures, but confirm purchase is nicer to look at. So we'll go into this and we'll see why is it failing. So if we jump into one of these, again, this is standard Application Insights. You can already do that. But when you're simulating 300, 400 users in your system or however many, passing in those user IDs can link them down and say, you can look at all the telemetry for that particular user session, that scenario. So you can look at these logs, some of these logs that might not be visible at your client because the response is just, the controller is just returning a 500. But you can then jump into here and link your recordings to Application Insights recordings. And so I can see that, oh yeah, SQL's failed. Let's see what happened. Why did that dependency fail? Oh, it's because it's not a valid query. That was a joke. Cool. So not digging too far into here, Application Insights, because you have everything in here, you can do everything you can do with Application Insights. You can generate real-time Power BI reports, whatnot. What I want to jump into is kind of the output from all of that testing, all of those logs. So every time you run a test, it's generating a log folder, essentially, with your different sort of levels of logging. You can download all your server metrics through APIs, so you query Application Insights, or you can query into New Relic or whichever tool you're using and pull down those metrics at the end of the test. And again, that's basically just a trigger that's saying when the test is executed and it's finished running, check the test environment, see what the start time and the end time were for that test, and download all of my metrics. Just do a big data dump. And you want to do a data dump every single time because Application Insights or New Relic or any of these monitoring tools, they'll only retain your data for a certain amount of time. So App Insights is 7 days, New Relic is 3 days. And so if you want to have a snapshot to be able to look at your tests 2 months later and compare your baseline, then you want to dump everything out into files and just save it. So this is an example from an example result set from the original project that I used this on. This is a real test, and this is the stress test that I ran on it. And it's run on one of the environments. I ran it on the SandPit environment. So you can generate Power BI as a template. So I've got this entire report templated, and every time I run a test, I can open up that template and point it to a different folder. So I have the exact same report. I have the exact same sort of nature of report for every single test, and I can compare and contrast between them. So just a quick summary of what actually happened, because it's a snapshot. You want to record your infrastructure setup and whatnot. I have all of my config data that I passed in, so my test period, get rid of that guy. My test period config here, the scenario config, and any other metrics that I'm passing in. So I'm passing in locations. I only want to use these 20 branches instead of these 60. And then this is kind of like the gold. So you can see kind of an overall summary, and we can see that we had an 85% success rate, which isn't really that good. Should have a higher percent. That's like saying if you have a 99% success rate, in on face value, it's quite nice, but that's saying, say you go onto Facebook, every 100 users, one user will have an error. Every 100 times you load the page, one time you'll have an error, which is relatively frequently, so should have aim for a relatively higher success rate. But we can see that after the 4 p.m. mark, there's a lot of these like little pink lines, and that's saying that there's a lot of errors happening at that point. So if we just look at the logs for before the pink line, we've got a 98% success rate. Now, there's some reasons why this is a bit lower, but this was a bit more acceptable for us. But we still want to know why we had the failure, right? What caused the failure? So let's jump into our layers. We've got layers, right, for the metric. So let's jump into one of the layers. So this is just looking at the overall scenario, and we can see that, yeah, there's a lot of noise happening up here. So if I just look at the successful scenario runs, not and ignore the failures, we can see that there's still passing, there's still successful runs happening after the 4 p.m. mark. It's just that there's more failures happening. So there's not much failures down here, but anything extra, every time I'm adding users, those extra users are starting to fail the scenarios, but it's still handling a load. So that's kind of identifying my peak load that that the current infrastructure setup can handle, right? But let's figure out what is actually going on. We want to know why it's failing. So we'll jump into the user actions. And yeah, lo and behold, there's one big line that's kind of going all the way up there with the response times, and that's the CRM saying, that's CRM giving errors. So we can jump into, look at the failures that are happening for CRM at the end. And if we look down at the exceptions that I've got returned, most of them look like the same ones. So if I go into one of them, it's basically saying there's too many active security negotiations at the service. So my current CRM setup is saying that, oh yeah, I can handle this much. Any other ones, I'm just going to return back because there's too many happening. So that's something that we needed to investigate. So that was one finding that was generated just by looking at these charts. If we then reset that and ignore just that CRM request, ignore. We can still see some patterns. So there's a couple of calls up here, two or three that are diverging, and then there's some at the bottom that aren't really affected by the user load. So that's kind of showing me that there's still something happening in the background that's going to be a bottleneck at some point. So again, we can dig deeper into that. And I have dug deeper into that, and if I just pull out some of them, it's kind of, yeah, we can see that some things aren't affected and some things are affected. And it just so happens that looking into the actual controllers and looking into application insights for these particular calls, that it's the AX call inside these controllers that's causing slowness. And that's reflected in the AX servers because they're all at 80%, around 80%. So you can correlate all of these. Now, this log was generated from New Relic. These logs were generated from the load test, and I know to look at AX because Application Insights told me. So you can combine all of these different things to figure out what's actually going on in your system. So that was the next thing to look at. Run the test again and put some monitoring tools within AX to see what's actually happening within AX. So that's the next test we're running. But let's go back, and let's just look at these successful ones. So there's a lot of successes here, but I don't know if you can see. You can see now. There's one sort of like peak in failures. There's something that happens at that 2 a.m. mark, and I want to know why. What happens? Because there's a lot of failures happening at that point. So again, we dig into the scenarios, pull out just that data, look at the failing ones, and yeah, we see a peak. And you go down to the exceptions. A lot of them are saying create appointment, complete job, book and schedule job. So those are kind of the more frequent ones that are failing. Okay, let's dig even further deeper and just look at the methods. Reset that. Pull out just the failing ones from just before the 4 a.m. mark. And we can see, again, the peak there. Let's click on that peak and see what's actually happening. You look at the exceptions, and a lot of them are saying... this is an older version of the harness, so the exceptions aren't as nice, but we can see that this one has returned with a 500 and just a generic message. So I want to know why. Like, what's actually going on? What caused this spike in failures, right? At sort of some, like, reasonable load. It's not even a high load. I would look into Application Insights, but before that, I can look into the individual HTTP requests that are happening. Now, that was the book and schedule step, so let's look at the book and schedule URL. And yeah, the variance is showing. When we see a big spike in the variance, that's saying there's a big spike in the actual data that's been collected. So we see a big spike here, which is correlated in the average run times here. The max run time is about 65 seconds, we can see. And this is the call, one of the calls that calls into our third-party external scheduling client, which happens to have a 60-second timeout on it. So the spike in errors that we're seeing is coming from our third-party client rejecting calls at some random point in time and timing out. And you can validate that by looking at another request that's also hitting that client. And yeah, we see that same spike at around 60 seconds, and it all fades away. So this was a third sort of finding that we got from these logs. And now we're investigating with that third-party client to figure out why there was those spikes happening. I could rant on about Power BI and what you can generate from these logs as much as I want, but you can kind of only do that because you have these different layers and you can identify different findings from each of them. And again, when you're reporting to sort of managers or project managers, you can say that, yeah, at the expected load, the user, when they click the complete job button, this is what they're expecting to see. This is sort of the response that they're expecting to see. Cool. So I ran through a lot of that really quickly. I hope made sense. So I'm just going to quickly run over what we covered. So wrapping up, we covered the questions, what you're trying to answer with these tests. Some of the theory behind load testing, and that's irrespective of what approach you use. You could do that with the existing tools. We talked about the tools, their limitations. Now, I want to reiterate, those tools are sufficient for a lot of the applications that you're using and a lot of the applications that you might be developing. But when you go into such a complex use case like we had, and I didn't even dig too far deep into them, they can sort of get really, really difficult. So... explain the code-based approach that we developed and using that in future projects, and also a brief overview of the reporting aspects with Power BI. Now, I just want to wrap up with one last remark. A load test is your fire drill, and I know a lot of projects skip the load testing aspect, but don't skip it, because before a failure happens, you can detect that and address it. Any questions? Yes? Yep, so the question was, how long did it take to set up everything, the BI report and as well as the coding? So I developed the harness and actually did some testing at the same time. So the harness setup was done once, and that's only done once. It's just preparing the library. When we want to go and implement this on a new project, it's basically, it depends on the scale of the project, right? You'd run through those steps, and I'm estimating maybe a week or 2 weeks maximum of getting those set up. It is a bit more involved in setting up the scenarios because you're not just click to record, you're actually coding it in. But maintaining them and updating them, it's kind of, there's the balance. In terms of the Power BI report, generating the template was, those are the graphs and the logs that helped me to answer the questions that that particular client was asking, right? You can modify those to whatever you need just using those logs. So setting up the Power BI report, maybe 1 or 2 days of work, but it depends on what you're trying to answer. Then you generate the template once, you write the code once, and then you can repeat that again and again. The source data was an actual test run that I ran over 6 hours on the project. That App Insights telemetry wasn't fully integrated into that because it's still under development. So I didn't download that for that particular project. Yep. Any other questions? Yes. Aha, good question. That goes back to my monitor the computer generating the load, right? So distributing a test is quite important, and a lot of these tools allow you to distribute and control that. That's something that I guess you could develop because it's you could add into that to control all of these different clients. But on the base level, you can copy your console app, it's just an executable, onto your different servers that you want to run it off, and just kick them off with the same test ID. Because it generates a test ID, and then all of the logs, you can kind of just collate them together into Power BI, and because you can, because they'll all be linked by that test ID. So distributing, it depends how complex you want. Do you want to automate the distributing, or do you want to just copy paste and run? If you have Octopus deploy or some sort of CI continuous deployment setup, you can tell it to copy your load test project or your load test executable onto X servers and then just kick them all off. Any others? Or are we all ready for beer season party? Cool. Thank you very much, guys. Don't forget to review. I'd love your feedback. And also, you can obviously get some nice goodies out of it. Thanks a lot. Jackie gonna be a football star. Diane's debutante backseat of Jackie's car. Chili dog, outside taste freeze. Diane sitting on Jackie's lap, got his hand.